You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Toby Keith here on a Thursday. Speaking of Toby Keith, joining me from Texas is Tim Lynch. Tim, what's going on?
Not much, brother. How are you?
I'm all right. Going up to 29 Palms today to go talk to some sergeants in 7th Marine Regiment. So fired up about that. Also joining us by the power of the magic of electronics is Jeff Kenny. Jeff, how are you?
Good, Mac. How are you guys?
I'm all right. I'm all right. You're in Southern California today, yes?
Yes, I am.
All right. I've kind of heavy-handed the show here the last few weeks, and I want to, what's anything on your mind today, Tim? Well, Tim wrote an article about the our friend, Major General Dave Furness, and some of the goings-on. And some of the comments that have been bouncing around the internet. So, Tim, you want to talk about that?
Well, yeah.
Hold on. First of all, tell everybody where they can find it.
Oh, okay. First off, I post weekly at The Freak, which is a veteran run blog. Mostly it features some traveling. It's stuff of interest to veterans and a lot of creative writing started by Luke Ryan and a host of Rangers from the 75th Ranger Regiment, a good group of guys. So and they allow me to publish in their blog, and so I normally do an Afghan update, but this week I decided to pile on top of Dave, basically because I listened to your show and then I went on Twitter and saw some of the nonsense on Twitter, and I was pissed. Most of the media have completely missed the point of the thing, which is the necessity of a CG to stand up and do this. And I mean, we talked about this ad nauseum, but this is the thing. And Jeff, remember this? I remember when General Van Riper came to supervise something, one of the royal family was coming out to watch something at Quantico, and they decided to do like some kind of hostage, rescue with an extract by spy rig. And we were out in the field, and they said, okay, so you're going to do it. We had to stop, and we had to do this thing, right?
Yeah.
And I remember that we were in trouble because we got called back. It was in Herr Schwerd's time, I believe. So Herr Schwerd was running the thing. And I saw colonels picking up trash on the side of the road. I'm like, oh, my God. So you know, the first thing that happened was is the general showed up, and we had to go get new uniforms for everybody. Then we had to rehearse this thing. I remember when he first showed up, I cut my salute early. I don't know why. I normally don't, but I did. And it took a full 60 seconds before he decided whether he was going to gut me or not, you know. He was micromanaging the hell out of this thing, and I was bitching. I was like, no, this is bullshit. I'm a captain. We're captains now, right? And I thought that all the way until General Van Riper handed CENTCOM's ass on that war game when they were war game in the 2003 invasion. And then I realized that the guy was a genius. And only when I started reading about him, then I realized that what he was doing and what Dave was doing was connected. Because he didn't articulate anything like that. It was weird, you know, but the guy was a genius. And it was the same lesson, but I didn't understand it.
Yep, absolutely. When this kid was going through the weapons platoon live fire, he came out and watched it. And this kid, you know how he did. Each lieutenant did like two assignments because we had two iterations of it, one on one day, one on the next day. So the first day, his kid was in the assault section. If you remember, they had to run down the south side of R7 through like a marshy area up over a hill, and then they engaged like enemy bunkers with SMAs and machine guns and so forth. So he's running down there behind his kid. He slips and breaks his fucking leg, breaks his ankle.
Whoa.
He gets a stick. And he humps up behind the kid, and he watches the thing. He limps on back to the fireside, which is all the way over at R6, if you remember. And then he gives this outstanding combat talk to lieutenants about, you know, being a lieutenant and a captain in combat. And then that night we had a Marine Corps University Society meeting at Mainside at 8 o'clock with him. He comes in at like 8:02, and he goes, "I'm never late, but the IOC guys broke my fucking leg this afternoon, and I had to get a cast put on." And, I was terrified of the guy because I remember from Lejeune, you can ask General Furness about this, when we were lieutenants, holy shit, man, it was like attention and detail time, making the stuff that that Dave is doing now look like, easy day type stuff. And I got a chance to see him in a couple of different modes. That mode at 2nd Mardiv, the mode when his kid broke his leg, what you're talking about, that thing we did there, you know? And then him as a speaker to Field Grade Officers. When he was in charge of, I can't remember if he was command staff or whatever he was, but he made all the majors do the O course. Remember that? And it was horrifying for them, because they weren't ready for that. You know what I mean? But, he's like a precursor to General Mattis. And that,
I want to frame the discussion a little bit. When we were captains, General Van Riper and General Van Riper is a contemporary of General Zinni. And like John
Black, right.
Yeah, John Ripley and these guys that were, platoon commanders, company commanders and advisors, General Smith, in Vietnam. So he starts this discipline thing and uniformity, standing lights, right? Garbage in your area. Everybody's packs had to be the same. Empty sandbags had to be in this pouch. Your socks had to be in this pouch of your pack, right? And so you'd hear this. But so this is what I'm framing. So telling people I want you to be more disciplined is one thing. The narrative, because to me that's what Van Riper did. I didn't get it either. Mm-hmm. I thought it was chicken shit too. Like, oh really? Now we're gonna play this fuck game? And I didn't understand it until years later.
Yeah.
That I saw the wisdom in all that. So the narrative. How important is the narrative? How do you get the narrative out? Because you're gonna, and one of the things that's been interesting for me is, you know, you'll hear guys say, "Hey, you know, I know guys that were not good Marines in garrison, but they were really good in combat." And you know, and so you think about that, and you can say, "Okay, how about if I grant you that that's true and valid, that can happen? Okay, that all of a sudden somebody's going to war, and now they get their ass and their brain wired together." And it's like, yeah, I got to go play You Bet Your Life. I better be all in on this shit. And I'll grant you that that's true. But what we're talking about is organizational discipline.
Yeah.
Not individual discipline. And so, but it's kind of interesting in that discussion. While you can grant them that what they say is true, they, because of their one-term, you know, participation in the Marine Corps, they never saw the Marine Corps from other than their squad, maybe their platoon, if they advanced that fast in that, you know, 4 years of their Marine Corps time. They never saw it from that perspective. So they won't grant you that the organizational piece is true, and so it's all bullshit.
Right.
So I'm curious about both of your comments about the context and the narrative of this thing. And why different views of it, you know, they differ so dramatically.
Go ahead, Tim.
Well, you remember last time we were talking, we mentioned Bob Coates, and I reflect back to my time in 1-9. We were very lucky. We're in the first Marine Camp Horno. We're the first MU socks that are leaving. We're the very first MU sock, as a matter of fact. So we're getting extra money, extra ammo, extra training time. But the Bravo Company guys of Coates, and then he was followed by Steve Hummer, just to give you an idea of the caliber of officers in that company. They were the small boat company, which everybody thinks is cool, because you think that riding a Zodiac off the coast of Southern California is fun, and it's not. It's miserable, you know.
That's
but,
sure.
But they, but they've also got the rigid raiders, and they've got trailers, and they've got no trained mechanics. I mean, they had to start from scratch a maintenance routine that was very demanding, as well as a training regime, which incorporated teaching everybody how to swim because they had to go down and certify in Coronado. And they were and they spent more time in the field and more time on that stuff, and you've never seen a more squared away company. And they were known. They were famous for their discipline, for always looking squared away and paying attention to detail and whatnot. And I, as a helicopter company guy, you know, we were looking for things to do often. We, you know, we didn't have as much, and I've often envied those guys, and I've often thought about them because, yeah, I've seen some Marines who were problematic in the rear, not so problematic with attitude like disrespecting authority and shirking their duty on a fire watch or stuff. I mean, just being kind of, you know, chip birds, attitude-wise and whatnot, that were effective in the field, sure. But I've also seen units that were uniformly effective in the field. And when you're out in the field, I mean, granted, I was never with a Marine unit in combat, but I've been up in the NTA for 5 days in the rain where it's just pouring. And I've seen people fold. I've seen units fold because of cold and rain. But you never seen units like Steve Hummer's or Bob Coates. And I would say our company, too. We had a great company of commanders myself. You never saw them fold. I mean, we sucked the weather up. You know, that's what are you going to do? You're just going to have to suck it up, right?
Yeah.
And that's the thing. I didn't recognize what Van Riper was doing, but General Hummer, and Bob Coates would have. They would have understood. They would have connected that shit immediately, and right. I didn't. And that just goes to show you, Dave is. That's what I tried to write about in a freak, and I concluded my article with what I consider high praise, which is Dave Furness has balls the size of grapefruit. He's betting everything on this move, and it's a very high visibility move, which indicates the depth of the problems, and it's not possible that it's resident in just the 2nd Marine Division. Not possible. We know it's not.
Well, and I'll just say this. It continues to be the top story today on Marine Corps Times. When you click on Marine Corps Times, the number one story for about the 6th straight day is the 2nd Marine Division and this discipline standout.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Jeff, your thoughts your thoughts about the narrative and how important controlling the narrative is, because if you don't get the rationale for it out there,
right,
I mean, then Marines will just say it's chicken shit.
Well, that's the sad fact of today. It used to be, You didn't have to have a narrative, you know. You just do what you're told.
Right.
And I remember, though, what you're saying about that, your first enlistment thing. My whole first enlistment, I had my hair to the nth degree as long as it could possibly be without me getting in trouble. And the reason was I wanted to go after and get girls, and we believed you couldn't get them without that.
Right.
So we barely did it. And I was in charge of very few people until I reenlisted. I became a squad leader and then a platoon sergeant. And as soon as I became a squad leader, I stepped on my dick a couple times in regards to leadership. And I noticed it. No one else did. Not even the guys I was leading, but I noticed it. And it was directly related to the example you set. And so, consequently, I started cutting my hair shorter because it's safer that way. I have to worry about it. And I started doing shit I never would do before, because I knew that if my folks didn't do it, like if a lance corporal, a sergeant could get away with a certain amount until he ran into a staff sergeant. But a lance corporal or PFC, as soon as he runs into the first guy who runs into, he's going to get his ass jumped into. And the higher it goes, the worse it's going to get. And so consequently, as you go through leadership ranks, both as a NCO and a staff NCO and an officer, you got to, by your appearance, and you got to obey all those rules. You can't show up unshaven. You can't need a haircut. You got to be doing it right, because if they look at you, they'll think they can do it, then they'll do it, and then they'll get nailed for it. So out of your concern for your people, you got to set a good example, and you got to demand it of them. And I think it was masterful that when Dave got called out on some nitinoid shit about somebody who's measuring his stars on a picture, he said thank you. Post thank you for, because nobody's above being corrected if they're in the wrong. Now, Dave's, I don't even think it was wrong. I think there was just a way, you know, his uniform was. I don't know if you guys know what I'm talking about.
No,
the way he reacted to it was masterful. You know, he said, hey, you know, but it sure as hell wasn't. And unlike Tim, who's did an eloquent article about this. I lashed out through my wife's Twitter account with a with a profanity-laced polemic about what shitbird babies they were for whining about just being held to a standard that is the standard for the Marine Corps. There's nothing special about it. So, you know.
I got
to
go.
I mean, I can send it to you guys.
So what somebody did was, I don't even know how you do it, but well, I do know how you do it, but they scrutinized his picture, right?
Right.
And this is under the guise of, at the State of the Union, right, the four-star in charge of the Coast Guard, I think, wore his ribbons upside down. Now, I'm not sure exactly how you do that, because those, by the time you're a four-star, you have a lot. And there's some that go at the bottom and some that go at the top. And your uniform looks like that every day. So when you put on your coat, right, and you look, like, I'm not sure how you look and say, hey, how is my, I was there in the summer exercise of my plebe year on top now and upside down.
But anyway. Maybe he's in the southern hemisphere.
So Dave says, I see this thing and I said, what the hell? And he said, I know. He said, look, you're with your second star, there's a bar that joins the two stars.
Right.
Right. And it's not like in the middle of the star so that you could, you know, there's a way to put them on. It's a little bit above. Now you can put it on and they could be upside down, but it looks right side up.
Right.
And he said, and the only way you'll know this is this little bar is a little, instead of being a little bit below the two stars, evidently, it's a little bit above or some shit like that. I don't even know. So somebody, you know, did the, like, let me scrutinize every star, every ribbon, and let me look at this shit, right? And so, that, I mean, it is what it is. But, you know, I think you're right. So, and the response, I guess, was, that I saw was, hey, thank you. I'll go and screw myself. You know, that's what I want. You know, and as Jeff said, none of us are above this kind of scrutiny. I think the narrative is so important, and that's why, you know, him talking about it.
Right.
And again, that's what, to me, the importance of the issue. And I'll tell you this, I'm incredibly disappointed. You haven't heard another Marine general officer talk about it.
Yeah, you're right, man.
And it's a conversation the Marine Corps needs to have. Because everybody will tell you it's a problem. Everybody will tell you that.
Well, we're all... These guys would crawl over their dead mother and screw their dying sister if they thought it would get them above the guy to the left and right of them, these star-wearing dudes. Some of them are great guys. Some of them are not so great guys. But almost all of them have that attitude towards each other. Almost. Not all. You know? The guy we're talking about now doesn't have that attitude. Neither does, a few others that I know, like General Alford, you know, and a couple others like that. But, you know, that is common, and that's what's being demonstrated by the fact that no one will raise his voice besides us Untermenschen on the outside now to back up Dave.
And again, it's not like they don't know it's a problem either. They see it.
Oh yeah.
They see it all over the Marine Corps.
Yeah.
All over the Marine Corps. And so, but again, the narrative, which is, so when you look at Dave's task inside the 2nd Division, right, it's to make sure that he gets them together and he articulates, hey, this is what I see. This is what I said. This is what I have. This is the corrective action I haven't seen. And I'm not content with, like, walking along and being a bobblehead. So here's what we're doing, and here's why we're doing it. And ultimately, here's the linkage between what we do here and what happens there. And ultimately, the better we are, the fewer of us, get dead.
Right.
And so to me, but you gotta own and articulate that whole narrative to people so you get the head bobble. And you know, so anyway.
That whole thing about the good in combat but shitty in garrison type thing.
Yeah.
That's beside the point, really. I mean, really it's like this. You're told you gotta do this. And let me tell you, I remember back in the old days, and Tim will probably remember this too, we had boots that were black. You guys remember that?
Yep.
We had brass that wasn't fucking anodized. We had to iron and starch our fucking camis and shit. It took a while just to be, you know,
squared away.
To be presentable. And so it's easy now. All it is just a little bit of attention and detail.
There is there's no preparation required. So if you got out of the Marine Corps before the year 2000, right? You know what the reality of Jeff at night, you could throw your uniform on the floor, right? You had to hang it up, make sure it was hanging so that you could get a couple days wear out of it because you had to iron it, right? Now, the only thing we need to do is somehow or other, right, do what the Army did, which is sew our rank insignia on, and you'd wash and dry those things and put your boots on, and there's no effort that goes into being a Marine.
None. Yeah. Sure. Remember, all the Marines had an inspection set of 782 gear. There wasn't one Marine who didn't.
Right.
Yeah, because come Friday morning, you lay out your stuff, and you're right. You know, you get it squared away, and you're on liberal early.
Remember that? It's like, well, you know, you're waiting for somebody to get dressed, and you're like, well, put those on. I'm like, no, I got to iron these. Those are my inspections. I only wear them for inspection, right?
The insanity on embassy duty, I don't even want to go into it.
Right.
It was insane.
Right, yeah. The same thing on sea duty. You met guys who taught you how to spit shine. And let me tell you, that spit shining was a fucking art, man.
Yeah.
They would have their a lighter. They would show you how to sand your boot down. They would show you how to melt the polish into all the crevices.
Polish and saddle soap.
Right. And I mean, these guys were like a spit shining artisans. They were like artistic. Yeah. And you should see the. Let me tell you. And we had the number one source of fights of Marines punching sailors on the USS Ranger when I was the executive officer there. was in the line for chow. Some sailor steps backwards with his steel toes. He's been up in the hangar bay with grease and shit all over his boots, and he stepped on my spit shines. Poosh!
Should have stabbed him with your Mameluke sword, man.
They would have, except they weren't wearing it. Right? But it was like, what happened? Sir, he stepped on my spit shine.
That's when I started liking Robert De Niro, because in Taxi Driver, he's a former Marine. And you see him, he's spit shining his cowboy boots with he lights that saddle soap on fire, he lights the polish on fire, and he's doing it, you know?
You're like, holy shit!
Yeah, I'm like, whoa, this is 76. We all cheered in the theater. Hey!
No, but that, I mean, so... And so, again, when you're born of that, and again, I think, and Paul Kennedy said this to me, Mac, all that stuff got us ready to go to war. It was exacting. It was attention to detail. It was on time. And that's the way you did it, and that's the way you learned it. And we did everything like that, or you got your shit aired out.
Yeah.
And so to me, that's why the discussion is so important, right?
Right.
And that's why the narrative is so important, and that's why I think the disappointment as the days go by and not another general officer speaks out on it is to me equally as disappointing, because they all know it's a problem. They all know it's a problem.
So, this guy came back from Iraq last week. This team came back from Takadam, and I'm talking to him. He's a lieutenant colonel, good guy, and he says, "Well, I don't really agree with General Furness. Why didn't General Furness go through his?" You know, he talks about going through the chain of command using the junior NCOs. And I go, hey, look, I went out to this guy's change of command in August. It was a problem then. He tried everything and more shit than you're saying to try and turn this thing around. This is the last, well, it's the second to last straw, you know, because he's trying everything to make that division combat ready. And you don't think he went through all that crap and it still doesn't work before he did this? Absolutely right, you know?
Well, it is kind of an interesting point when you talk to people. When they say that and you say, wait a minute, so this guy's got 7 deployments as a combat leader, and you don't think he did that? You think he just pulled this is the first card he played off the top of the deck?
Mm-hmm.
And then what you get is a stupid look, right? Okay, so let's assume that he's not stupid. Let's assume that he's smart. The other thing that he said doesn't get mentioned is that, you know, that schedule that was made came out of his sergeant's council.
Right.
So the question was posed to them, how would you fix it? And that's their solution to it. So, so again, and that's the importance of the narrative, though. If you don't, if you don't get that out, then you have people. Then you, you're the village idiot. Right?
But he does it battalion by battalion too. We know that from the post-traumatic winning thing. He, he talked to every battalion. He's not just on. He's not on one trip. I mean, we know this already, but I mean, this is all of a piece.
Yeah, but again, you know, when we talk about our own reaction as captains to Ben Riper, the lack of a narrative, the lack of an internet, to put it out there, and the other vehicles that, that you can use to put it out there, I mean, we just, you know, we looked at it and said, that's chicken shit, which is, I think, most Marines will give you, you know, oh, that's bullshit, what, you know, what, his wife didn't get saluted at the PX, so now he's going off on everybody?
Yeah, that's it.
Right.
But it's, you see, it's easy to do that to the story. It's very easy to put intent in there as incompetence or malice or some kind of personal adjustment thing. The beauty is that Dave is able to come on All Marine Radio and get this out. And there are people, and that's exactly what inspired me to fire and support, because the facts are disturbing that he had to do that. We know that that's a fact, but it's sure easy to make fun of him. And I'm just
Well, you know what, and that's, you know, but again, that's the media, right? It's like, easy to ridicule, right? But here's the question should be, so we're talking about a Marine general who in public has talked about the need for more discipline. And this guy's, this guy, I've looked at his record. He's a pretty experienced dude. What's going on in there? What's the deeper story behind this? And to me, the deeper story is a story that as you, I mean, look at the stories about lack of discipline, right, in the spectrum of the DOD, right? You have a Navy SEAL chief who's, who was accused by seven members of a SEAL team, junior members who got told not on one occasion, but on multiple occasions, let it go, shut up in color, decompress. The frag pattern of these things, if you start this, gets a lot of people implied to include you, and you're going to lose your chicken over this. And they ultimately came back and said, no, this is not right. So you have that story percolating. You have the stuff out in 7th Fleet, which you look at it and say, look, I don't care the state of your equipment, right? You're driving ships into other ships when we have the technology and we have the sailing capacity not to do that, right? And we're doing that. So, and so you're seeing this, this question come up is how much like our culture that, that, that doesn't do adversity, that doesn't do consequences, that, that doesn't do discipline, how much like our culture can we be? And what's, to me, that's a fascinating story. And where do we have to say, sorry, we can't be like that? If you expect us to locate, close with, and destroy the Chinese hordes, we have to be this way and we can't embrace that.
Yeah, I have to tell you, a lot of it is just the putting females in combat arms, putting these sexually adventurous people in with the troops, particularly the homosexuals. It's caused little cliques within each unit, and that is the truth. I hear it all the time. And these people can't be touched. And if they are, then the command climate thing will come out. We'll get rid of the COs in danger. And most of them ignore it. They ignore the, and so that consequently there's a, there's two different sets of behavior. One for your regular charheads and the second for your special people. And that causes a lack of, you know, a lack of veneration for leadership right there. And that is a huge problem. And I hear it all the time because kids come up to me and talk to me about it. And, that is a big, that was a big problem, I think, with that 7th Fleet thing.
That, you know, let me point out, I think there are very few places in America today where Jeff could say what he just said. But what he just said is true. When I was an enlisted corpsman, I noted that within the Navy medical branch, there was a very strong lesbian culture who looked out for each other. And they did subvert the chain of command. Because they did grant each other all kinds of special privileges and crap like that, you know. And you, if you said something, you did so at your own peril. Now, they got cleaned out after the big drug purge, because then they had a fat person's purge, and they got wiped out pretty extensively. But I guarantee you it's back again. And it permeates up to the Pentagon when you start talking about, like, on the Holly Grass, that Navy captain that got relieved for thumping her sailors and whatnot. And again, that kind of stuff is not good.
Right. Everybody needs to be treated the same, and it's just not happening. I remember when they first started stuff, I was the XO, SOI, immediate problems. Immediate problems with permanent personnel. Like you said, like-minded people band together.
I think the bigger issue is the whole, I would say, aftermath of Marines United, the hazing stuff, that if I yell at you, I'm hazing you.
Yeah.
You know, to me, it's like, as a leader, you know, if I push you, you're going to walk into the first sergeant and say, I'm hazing you. And then I'm going to get in trouble. And same thing with Command Climate Survey.
So you think Marines United is about that?
Well, I think in the aftermath, what has happened is leaders, right, how hard can I push Lance Corporal Kenny to unscrew him? And do I want to do it at my own peril? You know? And so this it started with they own the barracks. We can't tell them what to do. Right now, most people would say, well, that's a thing of the past. Is it?
No,
right?
I mean,
right?
it's always out there. The
right.
Lack of, you know, diligence and the lack of moral courage.
Right. And so to me, as a corporal, do I want to risk my career unscrewing a shitbird that's never going to be unscrewed if I get into his ass? And so what I'm left with, and to me, this leads me to a point of, you know, have we emasculated our NCOs and our staff NCOs to the extent that they don't have any real power? What can they do to me, right, other than make me write an essay? Whoopty shit, right?
So,
they used to be the foreman, right, who ruled the roost. Now, have we completely, you know, emasculated them in terms of, you know, any discretionary power, because, you know, they may abuse it, and that's not going to be a good thing. So I think there's a, you know, in the aftermath of these things, we become so sensitized to the hazing thing, right? So sensitized to yelling and mistreatment of other people. That it's like, wait a minute, like, if you forgot the tools, you know, that you were supposed to bring on a construction site and I yelled at you, is that hazing you? No.
Right.
If you watch the NCAA basketball tournament, there's all kinds of athletes that got yelled at. But in the Marine Corps, if you yell at somebody, you know, somehow or other, that's hazing them. And so to me, that's why this disciplinary, you know, thing is so important. Because, look, I know professionally my job is to correct you, right?
Right.
But when you peg the stupid meter in the middle of something that I personally corrected you for, and I yell at you, that's not on me.
Right.
That's on you. And if we can't say that, like, yeah, bro, you earned that shit, so own it. And let me tell you, I've seen hazing. You didn't get hazed.
Oh yeah.
You just got the rightfully deserved foot up your ass that you needed. And so I think that. There's all those things swirl in the mind of a young leader, right? And am I going to put myself in that position, or am I just going to say, "Hey, fuck it, write the essay. I don't really care. I've done my thing to cover my ass in case my sergeant tells me what did you do to him, McNamara?"
Right. Well, we've been here before, though. Like, I remember talking to guys who were in 3-1, the last unit out of Vietnam, and you had. And in Da Nang and in An Hoan, places where the Marines were there in Vietnam, in the rear areas, you had, like, tents that were exclusive black, occupied,
right.
And you couldn't go in there if you're a white guy.
Right.
The black shack, they called it and stuff.
Right.
Just to be fair, though, Jeff,
you know, you had the same thing with white Marines,
exactly,
right?
Exactly right. I'm just saying.
Right.
I'm just saying what happened was the things going on in society were allowed to inflict itself in the Marine Corps.
Right.
I remember reading about that in Fields of Fire and talking to James Webb when he came and talked to lieutenants, you know, at the IOC about that. And he said, you know what solved it was? Black staff NCOs. as far as that black thing went, and our and the regular, you know, the white staff and COs, all banding together and having one, you know,
standard.
universal yeah. standard. Yeah. That happened with us in 3-5. We had a black first sergeant who later became Sergeant Major of the 1st Marine Division. Sledge was his name, and he noticed a problem with out in Kinville of all places about these, you know, about the same type of thing. And they went in and cleaned it out. You know, him and you know, my former NCIC in Iran, who's a white guy. There was a guy named Top Tiano who was the ops chief of the battalion. They, you know, he was a Guamanian guy. They went in there and they cleaned it out, and they just wouldn't tolerate it. So that's what we need. I don't see that. The fact that General Furness has to do what he's doing means that Top Tiano and Sergeant Major Sledge and Gunny Stepp, they haven't been, you know, their descendants have not made themselves known, not to, you know, the good enough degree.
All right, let me read you an email. Mac, first of all, I've been looking forward to this segment ever since early this morning when I woke up. You know, I said this to somebody else who sent me an email like that earlier. That's a pretty empty life, I'm not going to lie to you. If you're looking forward to this segment, that you need to get into therapy.
This guy in prison?
Exactly. I want to make a point, or should I say equipoint, that you just made. How could you be a staff non-commissioned officer in the 2nd Marine Division and not feel professionally insulted?
Right.
Not feel like a professional failure. But I don't lay it on them. The institution of the Marine Corps has taken every tool that staff NCOs used to use away from them. You're right. Assign essays. Are you shitting me? That's what we do now? That's how we correct Marines. That's pathetic.
Yeah.
So no more punitive PT, no more digging fighting positions, none of that. That used to be the salt and pepper of the way Marines corrected. It was going to waste their time. It was going to be a little bit grueling, right? Nobody was going to get hurt. They were going to do it outside the barracks in some place where we had a bunch of those damn holes. And that's the way it went. And so now we're writing essays.
Yeah.
God help the Marine Corps. But my point is this. When you take every leadership tool and the only thing I can do is either sit down and talk to you, which works on the good Marines.
Yeah.
Or have you write an essay, which will never work on the bad Marines. You get what you get. The Marine Corps has sold its staff NCOs down the river. The same thing with his NCOs. So stand there and say, please, please, boys and girls. And the good ones will follow and will do what they're supposed to do. However, we all know the Marine Corps has a fair number that fall into the not-so-good Marines.
Yeah.
And for them, you empower them because they are not deterred by your counseling or your essay. Good
luck. That guy's got some good points. And talking to Dave, he said that one time he's about to get in this guy's ass. I think it was him saying it. And you were there, Mac. And out of nowhere, this corporal comes and he did it. Remember?
No.
It's not totally gone. He was even saying that. But it's too many people are not like the guy coming and getting there before him, you know?
You know, when I was a corpsman in Bethesda, I worked in a lab. And I was essentially no different than the civilians who were working in the lab, the hourly employees, right? I had a T-shirt over which I put a lab coat. The dark pants, I think we used to get them at Walmart because they're cheaper than the uniform shit store. I mean, I lived off the base. There was no supervision in the barracks when I was in them. There's none.
Right.
Nobody ever looked at anybody's room for any reason whatsoever. But I lived off base, and I essentially felt like a civilian. I there was no connection between me and the military at all in any way about how I conducted myself. And that's where it ends, you know. And like Jeff said, we've been there before. Because the Navy kind of for a while there, they got a little squirrely on what the chief's mess was supposed to be about.
Right.
And they did correct it towards the 80s before I got out. But towards the end of my time in as enlisted, the lab was a different place with a chief firmly in charge and you wore a uniform, you know, and at least uniform bottoms. So that did change some. But, boy, it's weird when you're part of an organization where you're just an hourly employee. I mean, you're not motivated to do much of anything. You don't really care. Yeah. Everything sounds like chicken crap because your existence is just doing an hourly employee job. And that's stupid. That's a stupid way to look at the military.
Yeah, but I think it's becoming more and more prevalent. Let me read you another email. Mac, I know that you don't believe this, but I want to tee this up, and I want to hear what you three have to say about it. If I listen to your last statement, my question is this. So you want to go back to me being able to lay my hands on people and to scream and yell at them? Period, question mark. I tee that up for you because there are some out there that will believe, based on what you said, that that's where you want it to go. Well, so let me, and thank you for the question. No, absolutely not. You don't need to do that. But what I want to get away from is if I yell at you because you keep fucking it up,
right?
That isn't hazing.
Right.
I don't need to apologize for unfucking you.
Yep.
And in my opinion, based on what I hear from my sons, from other leaders, right? That's where the Marine Corps is, a fair amount of the Marine Corps is.
Right.
And that's why they're terrified to have this discussion about discipline.
Yeah.
So, no, I'm not saying. But dig in a fighting position? Go out, hey, go out there and excel for me, son. And I should have tools to waste your time and play fuck-fuck, right? Yeah. And that I don't have to get approved by Congress, right? Right, yeah. I should be able to do that in a supervised manner. I should have some course of tools that allow me to say okay. And again, we called it playing fuck, right? So and so's getting reinspected at 1700 by the platoon sergeant and his squad leader.
Yeah.
Why?
Because he was
late and because of this and because of that. Okay.
You can have good discipline and stay within the confines of the UCMJ.
Right.
Even the way it is now, if it's enforced and understood, like the lieutenant is going to approve all the pro and cons for everybody who's, corporal and below. So each squad leader, then he's like a god. He should be, you know, and the squad leaders are ranked against each other in those first fit reps that lieutenant's doing. And yet they get total autonomy in ranking those three corporals that work for them when it comes to pro and cons. And so, the guy who's doing good, the squad that's the best tactically, the squad that's the least of an embarrassment in garrison, gets the higher marks and goes further and is more of a success in the Marine Corps. That's the way we do it, up or out, man. And that's how you push that. So then you let the sergeant say, I want my squad is not good enough. I'm going to keep them after hours because it matters to me to beat out the first squad. You know, and even though they're brothers and all that stuff, they're in competition with each other, and that's a good thing. I mean, you know, as long as it's done in a healthy way and as long as it's not done in a dishonest way, it will result in a better outfit. If Alpha Company and Bravo Company don't have a sense of competition, you got a problem in your battalion. And the same thing goes down to lower levels. And so that type of, you know, encouraging that is a way you help your guys enforce discipline. If third squad sucks and Sergeant Jones wants to, practice doing, fire movement or practice crossing danger areas and stuff, and he wants to do it at night, then the lieutenant should be able to go to the company commander and say, this guy's doing this and I approve.
I've never known a situation where 2 hours of close order drill after evening chow doesn't sort it out rather quickly.
Yeah,
but Tim, let me just tell you, if you suggested that, you would be ridiculed. You would be laughed out of the building.
That happened routinely at the 1st Marine Regiment when I was a lieutenant.
Not anymore, man. Close order drill.
That was step number one. Oh, we got a disagreement here. Oh, I'm sorry. Here's what we're going to do. And it got worse after that, but there was no laying of hands. Nobody's ever had it because you can't control that. You start,
right.
You let one guy do it one time and it's going to get out of control.
I'm not advocating that.
No, I know you're not.
But we are so far the other side, right? Is that what do I do? What tools do I have? And what I consistently get told is, oh, well, we make them write essays. Okay, well, no wonder you have a problem then. If that's all the juice that they have, right? And then the other thing they're afraid of is if I do get in that guy's ass, right, he's going to go to the first sergeant who's going to let him cry on his shoulder, and then, oh, poor baby, did somebody hurt your feelings? Come here.
Yeah, because the first sergeant came from the air wing.
Or right, right. And then, let me tell you, that is the biggest crock of shit in the world.
It is. We can agree on that.
Oh, my God. It's ridiculous. And so am I going to – so, you know, all right, then fuck that. I'm not going to stick my neck out for that shit.
Right.
And so, anyway.
All right. There is a magic bullet.
What is it?
And that is importing a bunch of Brit sergeants major. Because when it comes, I had one in Kabul when I was at the embassy. That was my chief training guy, right? And we're going down this stupid thing to one of these alleys that, and there was a Brit patrol in front of us, and they stitched the front of our car, shot it up. And I go, God damn, I'm like yelling. And the sergeant major goes, Tim, please, we don't need any of that. This is serious, mate. And he gets out, and he dresses this patrol down, not talking to the machine gunner, talking to his team leader. About this is a U.S. Embassy car, mate, and it was a 15-hour, and these guys looked like you would hit him with a log. And he never once cussed. He never cussed. That seems to be a British talent, that not cussing and making people feel lower than whale shit, you know?
That's why the British Empire. Wait a minute. Now
yeah.
It does set on the British Empire.
No, I've seen them do it. It's amazing. It's amazing what they can do, and they never cuss,
which
I think is unnatural.
Yeah, so do I. I don't know. You may or may not pick up on my oratory habits, but I'm.
Yeah, I got a lot of skill with a lot of experience with the Brits here in the last 5-10 years. Not a fan anymore.
You're not.
No.
Interesting.
Not at all. I mean, I like them, but man, they got some dumb ideas about counterinsurgency. And I'll tell you one thing. As much as I dislike them as a whole, it didn't come close to how much the Afghans hated them compared to – I'm talking their soldiers and stuff.
Really?
You know?
Man. Oh, yeah. Oh,
speaking
yeah. They were quick on the trigger too, man. They shot a couple of vehicles at I was in. And I was, that's a drag.
Speaking of Afghanistan, Del Alford's going to join – come on, Almarin Radio. Talk
great.
About Task Force Southwest. And so, so excited about that. Do you, either one of you two know Dale Alford?
I know him pretty good, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, no, I know Dale. I spent some time with him before he went over. I was going to try to embed with him.
Oh, that's right.
But I wasn't able to raise enough funds to do that. But, Dale's a good guy.
What I learned about him, he has been involved in combat operations at every rank he's ever held in the Marine Corps.
That's right. Panama.
That's amazing.
Field, yeah.
I've never heard that in my life.
Yep.
I've heard, you know, regularly, right, this, that, that. But at every rank he's ever held, from second lieutenant to brigadier general, he's been involved in combat operations.
I think most people would say, God, I wouldn't want to be have that much combat. But, we all say, what a lucky bastard.
He believed me in Liberia, his company.
Right. And you, like, he... So if you go through, like, you hear about his career, every little nuanced event, like, the Marine Corps doesn't go without Del Alford. Hey, where's Alford? Sir, he's not a part of any of the ULNs that is headed, oh, well, somebody better get us on there because we don't do this shit without Alford. So, and with all that comes, I've never interviewed him. I only met him last August, but, I'm kind of anxious because it'll come in, almost a sage-like wisdom, right? You would expect from a guy who's as bright as, and I've never, you know, he's one of those guys that I'd never met, but it's like, you know, like all my friends know him, right? And then they'll say, "Hey, Mac, well, you know Del Alford," and I'll say, "Nah, we've never met." Who's the other one? The other one is Jim Minnick, I think, is like that. Is another one of those guys that all my friends know him, but. I've never met him. So.
You know, we're all RSCOs together. Minnick, me, Tim, Dale,
yep.
Chiller.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, Minnick's a great guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So just kind
of. Yeah, he's one of Papa Jules' close friends.
Paul Kennedy.
Yep.
The yeah. So anyway, so no, it should be exciting because the other thing is fun to do an interview with somebody about a place that you've been, a place you've worked. You know, and all the different layers that go into Afghanistan, you know. So, what's the current situation? What is the, you know, what is he here as he does battlefield circulation about the Afghans' feelings about peace talks, about an American presence beyond peace talks. What would that American presence look like? How do you, you know, the age-old problem of, is there any way to transition the Helmand province out of opium into some other crop that continues to make money for them, and how much would the government have to subsidize it for, and is there an international plan maybe to lance that boil on the backside of any peace treaty? So, I mean, I think, you know, all three of us would say that, you know, that being involved in contingency operations and the insurgency and the war in Afghanistan and Iraq, too, they are the most complex, intriguing intellectual problems that I've ever seen in my life. And they're fascinating to look at the cultural dimensions of it, the economic dimension of it, the criminal dimension of it, the idealistic or the, you know, the ideologue dimension of it. And all this collides on the ground in these places. And you go there and you're trying to help. And so if you can't tell, I'm a little bit geeked up to interview Dale Alpert. So excited about that.
And when is that going to go?
It'll be on Monday. It'll be on okay. Monday. So,
I'll be listening to that, but I'll tell you what. The only way you would get opium out of the Helmand is through some kind of very, very harsh, draconian measures similar to what the Taliban did when they got opium out of the Helmand. Anything less than that is you're not going to be able to do it.
And now you're not going to be involved with something like that.
Wait.
You know, I say, sounds like an Afghan problem to me. And if we learned anything in the last 19 years, it's, you know, the juice, we gave them everything and then some, and they're still getting their ass kicked by a force they outnumber, they outgun, and they got more money than, that they need to do it themselves. You know, they need to do it themselves.
Right.
There's nothing else we can do for them.
And the other thing is, you might want to ask Dale, a couple of weeks ago, I think they lost an entire company in Sangin, which hypothesized came at the, because they were fighting in a built up area. There's too many civilians around I guess that's Watson over there now, for Southwest to bring their supporting arms to bear. But that's a pretty big damn deal, you know.
Company in Sangin. So was it like?
They attacked the damn Shorod. They didn't get near Southwest. But they went and breached the gate and attacked inside Shoreham, just like they did up at Balk, man. Lucky they didn't lose a lot more people. That's not good.
It's like a turkey shoot there. Bad guys kind of miscalculated that one. But you're right. I mean, just the fact they're doing it, especially during the peace talks. I mean, it's pretty much a slap in the face. You know, it's like, it's just
As unpopular, according to the stats that you were talking about earlier, Mac, as unpopular as that is, you go to that second Mardiv and ask Dave's Marine, hey, who wants to volunteer to go over and we're going to be outside the wire. We're going to hook and jab a little bit. Do I have any volunteers? Everybody does. It's the only show in town for the Marine Corps. Right. So it's not like anybody's bitching about going over there. That's really not the, from my perspective, that's not what the bitch is. The bitch is, are you doing anything effective?
Well, the bitch is that they're not going over. I grew up watching the wars, and I joined to fight, and now I'm sitting around here doing this shit. You know, screw this. But again, I heard Sergeant Major Zikapu said, you know, look, nobody joined the Marine Corps to be shitty. So the challenge to be better is I think what resonates. But I mean, again, it's on Dave to own the narrative. And, to take it back to where we started, the significance of the narrative, and I didn't see the wisdom of, and I would have loved, you know, I'll tell you what, and the closest I ever got was at PME with Zinni, but I would have loved to have sat and heard Ripley, Zinni, Van Riper, talk about their feelings about helmets and flak jackets. You know, why would Zinni say get rid of him, and why would Van Riper say no?
They did do that. Me and Timmy were there, and they were arguing. Zinni and Christmas were arguing about it. And the answer is this. The guys who were fighting in Hue City, it was a built-up area, not unlike fighting in Europe, fighting town to town like that. and you're going to be seen, and there's going to be a lot of shit flying around because of the nature of it. It's not a jungle thing. You know, it's not a patrolling type thing. It's taking the thing back block by block. They know where you're coming. They know there's not a lot of room for maneuver, especially when 1-5 had to cross and go against the Citadel.
Right.
It's a straight-up fight like Iwo Jima. And if they know that, then, you know, then that's appropriate place to have body armor.
Did they agree on that? Wait, hold on. Did they agree on that?
No. That was not something they disagreed at. But it was more like body armor and helmets were appropriate for you where you were operating out of Dwyer and the Hellman. But for guys like Jeff who were climbing up in the mountains of Kunar, that's bullshit. Those guys shouldn't have been in body armor and helmets because they rendered themselves combat ineffective by just walking through the environment. That was what the essential argument was. I mean, we didn't wear our flaks and helmets in Bridgeport, for Christ's sakes, for a reason.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, you'd think that they would, you know, if each other was – if their experiences were flipped, or if they had another set that was like that, they would have been different. The best I ever heard was Ray Smith, because he did both. He said just what Tim said. You know? Let me tell you something. When we were running away from the NVA in 1972, I didn't have my helmet and flak on. You know? And
Ray Smith is funny.
Yeah, he is.
Ray Smith is funny. And I mean, I just did an interview with a guy who wrote a book about Sergeant Major Canley. It's called The Gunny. His name is John Legato. He was a PFC in Alpha 1-1. And it's really interesting. You know, Smith is I saw a short interview he did about it. And Smith said, I don't think he would have told you this at the time, but, you know, Gunny Canley was a fatalist. He believed that there was something with your name on it, there was nothing you could do about it. And I think most people that spend any time forward become fatalists. That, you know, I see guys who've been killed who shouldn't have got killed. I see guys who live who should be dead. I don't know who steers metal, but all I know is I don't really have a vote in it. I'm going to do the best I can do, and I'm not going to fail my Marines, but I'm not worrying about it anymore. Because
yeah, Ray Smith, the chaplain we had in 3-8, was a guy named Rochford, Dennis Rochford. He was Smith's radio operator in that platoon during Hue. And then they went on Operation Pegasus, 1st Marines did, up to Khe Sanh. And before they went into Hue, they had been up on Khon Tien. So they had both experiences,
yeah.
You know?
Right.
And Smith was, when fucking Gonzalez got hit by that RPG, which just, you know, devastated him. It shocked the those guys worshipped Gonzalez.
Right.
Alfredo Gonzalez, the squadron who got the Medal of Honor. And they started to run out of the buildings. And according to Rochford, Smith's like, get back up there, you chicken shits and shit, you know. And, you know, it was just, they put it on a real personal level,
right.
You know, all that stuff.
Right. And Smith is, he's one of the smartest guys you'll meet. I mean, he was fluent in Vietnamese, which is not...
Yeah.
It's not a romance language, okay? It doesn't make any sense to us. And the rest, I mean, those advisors still have reunions, you know, with the guys who they fought with in Vietnam. And I'll tell you what, you ever want to read, you know, the Bridge of Dong Ha, the Easter Offensive, what Smith and John Ripley
and Livingston,
what those guys did? Holy, I mean, you talk about the strategic captain.
Right.
Yeah, those guys.
We had a
amazing
PME at 8th Marine Comm thing there at Lejeune when I was a lieutenant, and Smith had Ripley, who was 2nd Marines, and Livingston, who was 6th Marines,
and
he just gave up 6th Marines to another guy, but they talked about it, man. It was like, it was hair-raising. You know?
Right, it was like heaven for PME heaven. But
yeah.
So to me, I mean, now, he doesn't listen, so I don't really give a shit about saying this, but my younger son was a part of the Sea Dragon thing with 3-5 experimenting with squads and shit like that, right? And he said something that was uncharacteristically brilliant, okay? And I've never said this to him, but I'll say it here because I know he's not listening. When I asked him, so what do you think, right, about squad size? And he said, well, the conclusion that we came to was it depends on your mission.
Right.
And I said, what? Who'd you hear say that? He said, what do you mean? I said, I know you didn't come up with that. He said, whoa, oh. And then we got an argument about that. But that would, but would you ever now, would a commanding officer ever say, yeah, we're going out slick now?
No.
No, because if somebody got killed, right? Their parents are going to hold a press conference, and his name and his picture are going up on the TV screen saying, this guy made a decision that got my kid killed.
Right. And so that's the great thing about the book Black Hawk Down, because the Rangers freely admit, a lot of them didn't even bring out their sappy plates because they didn't think that there's going to be any, or they didn't put their back sappy plates in because they had no intention of turning their back on the enemy. And sergeants like Sergeant Eversman, the hero of the thing, he admits it. I mean, that's a good thing about that operation is those guys are very honest in the after actions, of what happened there. But that's exactly right. You know, you got to watch that. Depends what your mission is, thing because. And you got to really be judicious because, you can end up fucking yourself.
Yeah, but you can't. But again, the weather, right?
Yeah.
And your physical stamina, that's a part of.
Yeah, sure.
That should be a part of your mentee, right? And that goes into saying, okay, what are we wearing? What do we expect? Now, look, if the world tips upside down on you, mm-hmm. I mean, should you plan for that? I don't know.
No, those guys went in the late morning, and they didn't take any NVGs. They ended up being out there all night.
Right.
So the guys in the Little Birds had Willie Peter bags full of NVGs that they're trying to drop to these guys in these little isolated positions so they could – because otherwise they're like trying to guide in, infrared air fire support from the helos up there. And basically it was just Little Birds. And a little bit from the Blackhawks, trying to guide in these things, and they had no NVGs to see where where those laser pointers were going.
Right.
So they drop it to them in Willie Peter bags. And I was in WTI, we had guys from the 160th Special Ops Squadron doing a PME there, who are also going through WTI. So you can get ridiculous. I mean, you can bring cold weather gear in the jungle because who knows? Right. Like you said, it might. Right.
You never know. Hey,
No,
within a certain amount of, you got to be judicious about that.
That is funny that you mentioned that because just when I was listening to Mac talk to that wave vet, what did that guy say? We left our packs back there because we're only going to go until the morning. He left half their shit behind.
Right.
It always happens that way, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But what are you going to do? Take your packs into the attack at some point?
No. I don't like being separated from my pack. Yeah, I'm a helicopter company guy. That's bad business.
Yeah, but when you're running for your life, to quote General Smith, I mean, fuck that.
No. But back to that specific conversation. I was in call now talking to the company commander for Bravo 1-8. I'd been Bravo 1-8 CO back when I was in 1-8. And he had been with McManus in the Kunar earlier in 2000, I guess that's 4. And I had asked him, I said, why the hell were you guys climbing up that goddamn Suato Tall with helmet and body armor on? He goes, that's when we went to Bridgeport, we left that behind because of the height. And he goes, no, we had to. He goes, there were times. He goes, I'll tell you straight up, we were completely combat ineffective when we were laying on our backs gasping for air. Because we're climbing up past 12,000.
Yes. It's like over 10,000 feet up there. Man.
Yeah. And it goes, and I said, but why didn't you guys ever take that shit off? He goes, because of the mothers of America. If one of the guys had gotten hit and we didn't have that stuff on, that's it. It's the end of the world. Even though I guarantee you I'm losing people because they can't move fast enough. And we're letting the enemy go.
Well, that's the key. I think that's the key thing is the enemy outcycles you at every turn because you can't physically keep up. And let me tell you, and it's not like our guys are in great shape. I mean, the number of
awesome shit.
The number of heat casualties that you have in Iraq and Afghanistan for the work those guys do is phenomenally low. They learn how to hydrate themselves, their bodies adjust, and it's hotter than shit, and that stuff is heavy as shit, and it keeps all the heat into your body. And so it's amazing how few we have. And when we do have them, normally it's because somebody got a shipment of some shit from the United States to make their muscles bigger, and it fucks up the ecosystem, and then all of a sudden you're medevac 4 guys out of a unit, and you're like, the fuck's going on down there?
Or those rippets in the
Shit.
Yeah, hey, you know, on my first deployment, our
Hold on. But I just want, that is a real threat. I mean, and that's why I would have loved to have seen the conclusion of Christmas, Zinni and Van Riper and those guys talking, where that you would say, look, you've got to do a mission analysis. And right. If you're going to go in the jungle and you're going to go climb up and down mountains in Northern I-Corps chasing the NVA, you better be able to go, and you're not going to be able to keep up if you have helmets and flaps. Right. And are you going to lose a few guys? Yes, but on balance, you're going to save more than you lose because you're going to be able to kill them, right? And you're still going to have gas in the tank when you make contact.
Well, that's like my kid. I was talking to my 1-6 kid. He went into Afghanistan with Asad Khan. And Asad went and bought from a fucking vendor in Afghanistan plate carriers. And he had his guys leave their goddamn, those jackets we had back then, leave them. And they did plate carriers. The guy had balls, man. You know, and he cared about his guys. I mean, he got those. Then pretty soon everybody's carrying them things, you know. Right, everybody's getting them.
Right. When Frank Labuti is a contemporary of all those guys, General Labuti, mm-hmm. and he was my first new commander in the 80s.
Yeah, 1-9, four-star guy.
Right, and he was very specific on operations about when you took the helmets and flags and when you did not. And right. as we were doing Westpacs, most of the time we did not. And it seemed to me like common sense. I mean, he was very specific about it, and he spent a lot of time explaining himself.
Well, you know,
and Moody was the Operation Buffalo guy.
Well, let me.
And it was a pain. It was a pain in the ass for the helicopters because they had to go cough up enough of those damn head protective stuff when they're lifting us because we didn't have our helmets. So they were bitching about it all the time.
The cranials. Like in the discipline thing, you need that top cover, and that's why senior leaders need to make these decisions and articulate them for exactly that. Hey, boys, one of our weapons is speed. We're going to get on them. We're going to chase them down, and we're going to do away with them. We're going to kill or capture them. We're going to render them inert as a force, all right? And in order to do that, speed is a greater asset of ours in this operation than protection. Because our speed is going to be part of our protection, and we're going to go get them. And then armed with that, right, all the subordinate commanders, you know, I know. But, again, I just don't – now we're in this thing that, you know, who would leave them behind? And so, as a result, the enemy flees and gets away because you can't keep up. Well, everybody's still alive, though, right? Right?
Yeah, you're right. That's exactly right. And that's the whole thing. That's the conundrum. You know, what you wear helps you get hit, but what you wear keeps you from getting hit fatally. But maybe if you weren't wearing it, you wouldn't get hit in the first place.
Right, because you would have been closer. Man. You would have closed with them. Yep, I'm with you.
Hey, Jimmy Gant went up there and tore some people a new asshole with not that many guys and without work because he got fired for not having his protective gear on, but he understood it.
Well, and that's why these discussions, again, and when we kind of pinged on what Dave is doing relative to discipline, but that's why these discussions are so important to have, to have them as adults. And because, you know, if you are going to go close with the Russians or you are going to go close with the Chinese or the Iranians, you better have your ass and your brain wired together and you better be lethal because when you're not, when you're less disciplined, when you're less lethal, we pay a higher bill in dead bodies and nobody wants to see that. And again, that's why I would hope that this discussion started in the 2nd Marine Division broadens out to, hey, let's take a hard look at ourselves. Have we emasculated our staff NCOs and NCOs, or would they look at me and say, you know, Mac, you're kind of come from a different era. We don't need to do it like that anymore.
Yeah, we do.
Well, but just that kind of a discussion where we would say this, okay, got it. Okay, so maybe I'm an old guy, but let me just tell you this. We've got to get over this. You yelled at me. That's hazing shit. We've got to get off that stuff.
I guarantee you, Dave Furness, when he's sitting down with his sergeant's council, would rather be talking about whether you do or do not wear helmet and body armor in Bridgeport, California during the mountain package then right. how do you get guys that can have haircuts, and should you or should you not have a serviceable uniform?
I think it's the same discussion. I think it's the same discussion. It's the willingness of a commander to address issues that need to be addressed because he cares about how we're going to perform in combat. And I think either you're willing to go there on a consistent basis, regardless of the issue, or you're not. And he's
But one topic's a little bit above the other. You know what I mean?
Well,
one's further downstream where you want
right.
to be.
Right, but again. Yeah. You're blowing smoke up your own ass if you don't have the most fundamental conversation. And let me just tell you, there's a lot of smoke blowers in the Marine Corps. A lot of smoke blowers, because we're gonna play the Emperor's New Clothes, right? And we're gonna fake it, because for me to have this conversation in a public way, holy fuck, what's gonna come of that?
Yeah.
Right.
Anyway. All right, I gotta go up to 29 Paul. Talk to
have fun, man.
Yeah, I will.
Hey, drive safe, man.
I will. All right, there you have it. The brilliance of Jeff Kenny and Tim Lynch here on display on a Thursday. So that'll do it here for another incredible segment of All Marine Radio here on a Thursday. Don't touch that dial. We'll check news. You'll hear. You'll hear. You hear some thoughts. Again, programming note. The Commanding General Task Force Southwest, you'll hear an interview that I'll do with him on Monday. Brigadier General Dale Alford. And, Dale, how about that? Been involved in combat operations at every rank he's ever served in the Marine Corps. I've never heard of that in my life. Yeah. Dare I say chesty puller? Yeah, how crazy is that? Straight up crazy. So, anyway, so don't touch that dial. You'll hear talk about news today, and then you'll hear this thing repeat itself. If you haven't caught up on your listening, let me just encourage you once again. This week, listen to an interview I did on Monday with a Marine by the name of Josh Gilkey. He attended post-traumatic winning twice. And he's a young Marine, he's a corporal. And the reason I tell you to listen to him is he's a young guy and how it resonated with him. And then on Tuesday, John Legato came on and talked about the book he's just written called The Gunny about Alpha 1-1 in the Battle of Way City. And that is the battle during which their gunnery sergeant, John Canley, later to become Sergeant Major Canley, was recently awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor. So it's a pretty cool interview. And then if you missed Grant Newsham yesterday, don't miss out. So, yeah, and then we continue. So, don't touch that dial. More of All Marine Radio coming up next on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network, and the chef will join us tomorrow. Have a great day. I'm on my way to 29 Palms. Out.